I don't use a potato peeler. I use a knife. And I think the reason I do that is because my mum is left-handed, so she can't use a potato peeler, right? But what this means is when I cut a potato, first of all, a whole bunch of actual potato goes in the bin along with the peelings. And secondly, okay. It's got this kind of very angular, low-poly look once I've peeled them. And as far as I can tell, that's what the Cybertruck is.
Hi everyone and welcome to Bad Voltage. This is episode 60 of season 2. I can't believe how long we've been waffling on for this podcast. It's quite impressive. So I'm here with my compadres, Mr. Stuart Ian Langridge and Mr. Jeremy Jessica Garcia. And we're just going to... I just like how he's sitting there right now just sadly shaking his head from side to side.
I'm not mad. So, I'm just disappointed.
Right. Yeah, I'll take it. That's a step up from what I usually get. So we're just going to wander through a whole load of news. There's quite a lot going on right now.
There is.
So, Jeremy, why don't you kick us off with something to talk about?
Sure. Why don't we go with the recent issue with the .org registry? So right. For those of you... For instance, I presume Jonathan Edward James Bacon, who aren't familiar with what happened here, I'm going to go through a brief introductory. So,
yes.
Ethos Capital, which is a new PE firm, really just founded in the last couple months, run out of Boston, has about...
For those people who don't know, using Jeremy's elitist lingo, private equity firm.
Yes, sorry, private equity firm, investment firm, if you will.
They're not big fans of Public Enemy.
Chuck D would not be thrilled. They just announced a deal to acquire the 501c3 nonprofit that currently runs the .org, PIR, Public Internet Registry,
right.
For an undisclosed sum. So there's a lot to unpack here, and the history is super, super long, but I think you need some of the information to really understand what's going on. I'll go through just a little bit of it, but I'll add to the show notes a link with quite a bit more information because it's kind of an interesting progression and I think indicative of some places where the public-private revolving door, if you were, is probably having some negative impacts here. But So to go all the way back to 2003, as part of the deal for VeriSign to keep the .com registry, which they deemed much more valuable, they agreed to give up .org. There was a public bid. That bid was won by the ISOC, which is the Internet Society, which is a nonprofit dedicated to kind of open development, evolution, and use of the internet as a public benefit. And their winning bid was kind of predicated on them setting up a separate nonprofit, that nonprofit taking control, and then a small amount of money from what they founded ended up being PIR. A small amount of money from each registration would go to ISOC, and now that's the dominant source of their funding, about $50 million a year.
Right.
Fast forward to about 2010, the ICANN, as you probably now are well aware, began to pursue a kind of, let's say, expansion of the TLDs. There is basically now dot everything. Mildly surprised you don't have dot Jano at this point.
So I actually do.
It wouldn't surprise me.
No, I don't.
Also, just be Jono at Jono.
That'd be great. Jono. Yeah. So also during this time frame, roughly about 2010, they decided to reverse their policy. ICANN, this is. It used to be that a registry could not own a registrar. They got rid of that. And one of the largest ones that was founded is called Donuts.com. And this was founded by a group that was heavily lobbying for that restriction to be lifted. So
did you say Donuts.com?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that was
yep.
what I heard. All
right. In 2012, the CEO stepped down and the COO, Akram Atella, took over as CEO and then ended up recommending a childhood friend of his, Fadi.
Did you say Atella or Nutella?
Atella.
Okay, just because we're talking about donuts.com. Anything's possible at this point in the story.
Nutella was busy running Microsoft.
Fast forward to 2019. And the Public Internet Registry asked ICANN to drop a price cap on .org registration. So there had been a limit on how much you could raise the price of .orgs, which I don't know that most people realized. Part of the reason for that was it was supposed to be for the public good. Now, as part of this, the Public Internet Registry touted the fact that they were a nonprofit as a reason to approve this. Like, hey, we would never raise prices aggressively. Why would we? We're a nonprofit. So ICANN opened this up to public comment. They got roughly 3,300 comments. Exactly 6-4 ended up passing it anyway.
And just to step in very briefly there, normally when they open stuff up to public comments, they very rarely get more than 50 comments. This time they got 3,300.
So this is a landslide of opinion, all skewered in one particular direction.
Correct. And then they went ahead and did the opposite of that. So what's interesting here, now that you have those lists of names, and there's a reason I went through that. So on May 7th, Chihadi, who you remember was the CEO of this, registered the domain Ethos Capital. On May 13th, ICANN went ahead and lifted that price cap, and on May 14th, aka the very next day, Ethos Capital was incorporated in as an investment firm. So seems an interesting timing that the day after ICANN passed that is the day that a PE firm whose only investment so far has been PIR was founded. So it seems to have something to do with it. At least you would think so.
So what do you think, based upon your experience? I was going to say just Jeremy, but both of you. What does this mean for people who are listening to this who have a .org domain?
For example, me.
And you. Yep.
And me, in fact. But also, we are technically listening to it, but we're so self-absorbed, we're only talking about each other. What about other people, you egotists?
So Ethos has come out very clearly and said that they will raise prices, but will do so what they consider respectfully, which they classify as 10% or less per year.
What?
As in,
from my point
every
year.
It just says annually.
Based upon the theory of compounded interest.
Yes.
Now you see the concerns, and they're not beholden to that promise. Of course, they can do what they like. Sure. That's what buying it means.
But so to finalize the story, after Ethos Capital bought them, PIR gave up their nonprofit status and now is for a for-profit company. It is the kind of close to the story.
So, it's... Given the idea that ICANN dropped the price cap in June, or May was it? Sorry, Jeremy, I had June in my notes. But in June, they decided to drop the price cap on .org domains and say, well, we can start charging more for them now. But as was mentioned, everyone kind of went, well, we don't really like that idea, but, you know, you're a non-profit organisation, so okay, no problem. And then, less than 6 months later, sell the whole thing for profit to a company who's looking to make profit on it, who was set up 30 seconds after the decision was made. It's quite hard
by people involved and impacting the decision.
Yes, it's quite hard to avoid the conclusion that when they did drop the price cap, they knew this sale was coming and didn't tell anybody. And this change, the asset, the Ethos Capital, a firm which has been around for 5 minutes, have now acquired, is now worth billions rather than millions of dollars. There are a shedload of .org domains. Yes. And if you double the price overnight, which you could do quite easily, then suddenly they've doubled their money. They can do that every year.
Right? And what's especially terrifying about this is this is not as simple as switching to a different product, right? Like, part of the reason why the market, the capitalism works is that if you have a product and the price gets too high, then it's a pain, but you basically move to a different product.
There are no market forces here. I can't pick buying cryogenics.org off someone else. That's not how it works.
Right. Well, and the thing is, as well, is you have your online identity attached to that.
20 years of it.
If you move to cryogenics.biz, which I
to
think
be
you
clear,
do,
that's not happening.
You should do that regardless of how this discussion ends.
Yeah,
I think
that
would be
cryogenics.museum.
I think you can sell, like, Your business could be, you know, web consulting and Viagra.
Yeah, I'll be an Alibaba reseller or something. That'd be fun.
But I mean, realistically, the thing about moving is you need a redirect or else it doesn't really work. So you'd still need to pay in.
You'd still
to
need
have
the domain.
That redirect at least for years.
I mean, I'd never get an email again. This is terrible.
And well, I transitioned over from .org to .com.
Yeah.
And I will never, ever stop having the .org because always going to be links that are going to break, right?
Yeah. So. Exactly.
Wow, that's
really... And I've got stuff linking. I've got stuff linking to my website from 15, nearly 20 years ago. Jeremy's got even longer stuff.
I mean, the amount of links to LinuxQuestions.org is staggering. To lose that because the price went up would obviously be disappointing.
I think the most concerning thing about this is how much it looks like a really dodgy backroom deal for pure profit being done by a group of people whose responsibility it was to not do precisely that thing.
And I think part of the disappointment is, like, in 2012, the Senate actually looked into ICANN and said, like, hey, and this is Congress said, the revolving door between private and public here is too much. And that's coming from Congress. So I think it's just disappointing to see someone that you think were going to be good stewards of something end up not being maybe as good a stewards as you thought. So it's just disappointing.
I think
this does sound like that it would break some kind of legislation, or I mean,
it's not very clear that there are actually any rules for this sort of thing, really. No. I mean, there are rules, but they're self-imposed. There is no governance on this, almost by definition. And if there were, it would be the US government doing it, or who would at least assert the right to do it. I'm not sure I want them running it either.
So I think the interesting question here is engineers have a interesting history of routing around things they don't end up liking. So while I've not heard of anything specific in this case, there's obviously rumblings of not liking this in general. Do you foresee some kind of alternate DNS/TLD system popping up? Because it would be a monumental undertaking.
I mean, things like OpenDNS have existed for 15 years. Nobody uses it. It's not hard. Right. I mean, all you have to do, it's not like you need to invent new technology for this. We just designate a new set of root servers and everyone switches to them. Boom, done. But
yeah,
I say
that's easy.
Yeah, that's how difficult could that be? Next topic.
But I believe this is the reason why the term boiling the ocean was specifically created.
I mean, I think there is a kind of feeling among a lot of people in our industry that the whole internet infrastructure kind of works by magic. It's like, it's not like there's actual companies and people paying to do this and run servers and everything. And actually there is. And I think in the last 10 or so years, we've started to see some of those companies who were originally going, yeah, we'll just donate one of the root servers because we think it's the right thing to do, start saying, we'd like a bit of return on our investment. That would be nice. And I can kind of understand that. And that started to expose how much of this stuff is actually being run by people who think maybe we shouldn't just do this for nothing. But I think there's a difference between that and going, okay, the .org registry, which was explicitly set up as a kind of, you know, for the health of the internet and the internet as a public good and so on, can just go, hey, we're going to sell this to a for-profit company who have said we're going to use it as a way to make profit, get a shed load of complaints about it, then write a thing which says, there was a certain part of the community that complained, but not everybody. Well, as far as I can tell, the part of the community who complained were everyone who's got a .org domain, right? This is like Ford putting out a thing saying, tomorrow, all Ford cars will explode, destroying everyone inside. And then going, a certain part of the community complained about this plan, i.e. everyone who owns a Ford car. All the people with Toyotas weren't that bothered, so we think it's okay, right? It's infuriating. And there's nothing you can do about this.
Yes.
I don't like the idea of private equity firms involved in any of this. And the registrar should be, as far as I'm concerned, this should be for the public good, and they should be maintaining the lowest possible.
And the fact that it was the stewards of the public good that will now benefit the most is, I think, what is the most disappointing about it.
It is, yeah. It is. I suspect we have not heard the end of this particular story. Shall we move on?
Yes.
We shall. What do you have?
I would like to talk about Google Stadia, or Stadia, or PlayStation Fail, or whatever you want to call it. So in a nutshell, this is Google's answer to a set of services that have been springing up recently. There was PlayStation with PlayStation Now. There is Microsoft with Xbox, with xCloud. And the basic idea is that you can use a device, in this case, it's a Chromecast Ultra, or if you want to do it on a TV, or you can just do it in your Chrome web browser, and you can basically connect to a service where you can play video games over the cloud. Now, you don't need to buy any hardware, you don't need to buy games console for this, which is, you know, usually will set somebody back kind of $200 to $500, depending on what you buy. But you basically pay, I believe it's $10 a month to get access to the service. And then, importantly, it's not a Netflix-style service. You then have to pay for the games. And they do have some plans where you can pay to have it kind of have 4K gaming. And you'll get, like, I think a free game every so often, kind of like PlayStation Plus, where you get a couple of free games.
So the monthly subscription, just to be clear, is 100% optional. You can have Stadia without the subscription. It gets you 4K streaming. 1080p is the standard. It gets you discounts. It gets you free games, like you said, similar to PlayStation
That's
Plus.
What I'm
and
thinking
a few
of.
Other yeah. things. Yes. But it is optional.
So basically what they did is they sold some packs of this. There's the Founders Edition
and the Premier Edition.
And the Premier Edition. And it comes with a control pad, which, from what I understand, feels like a pretty meaty control pad that's similar to a kind of a Nintendo game, Nintendo Switch kind of pro pad, which we've got a Switch at home for Jack, and they're pretty nice feeling pads. I've not tested out the Stadia one yet. Anyway, so it launched, as we record this, last week.
Yes.
And the response has been variable, from what I can see. Some people have said that it's impressive that how well it works. So, like, the level of latency is pretty low on Stadia, particularly for if you're playing games that don't require a keyboard and a mouse. But if you're playing it with a control pad, it's actually not massively noticeable, but it's a bit noticeable. Like, people playing Mortal Kombat, for example, when you do these special moves, it feels just a tiny bit sluggish. But generally, it works reasonably good. A lot of people were quite annoyed the fact that they stream in 1080p. Because when they originally announced this, there was all of this talk about 4K streaming. And Google came out with some measly words, basically saying, you know, game developers are choosing the resolution based upon their artistic preferences.
And it's got nothing to do with the fact that Destiny is 1440p, because we can't do 4K and actually do that fast enough to your house or anything, which is what everyone assumes the problem is, that this is a bunch of lies designed to cover up the fact that the technology can't handle it.
Right. So what I've seen is that journalists generally feel like it performs at least as good, if not better, than the competitors. I actually bought Stadia, and I cancelled my order, which almost never happens. And the reason why was because when I was looking into the data usage after I'd ordered it, which I didn't see in the Google site, I saw like the what kind of, you know, net connection you need, and I've got gigabit at home. To play for a typical session, it was like an hour. It was something like, you know, it was a lot of data. It was like, you know, 20 or 30 gigabytes. I forget what it was. And I have capped internet access. I can download a terabyte a month with Comcast before you have to start paying for more.
So you have a capped internet?
You've capped internet?
Yeah, a terabyte a month, which is a lot of data, to be fair.
Have you thought about...
streaming a bunch of 4K all day.
Wow, yeah. Have you thought about moving from 2001 to 2019?
Look, if you can give me a better option, I can't get anything else if I want gigabit. So the thing is if in our house, if, you know, our kid is watching 4K TV on Netflix, which most of it is these days,
yep.
My father-in-law is back home in his little cottage and he's watching TV. Eric and I are both working. We're on video conference calls. You burn through a terabyte in a month with no Google Stadia. Sure. And most people don't have gigabit Ethernet internet connections.
They do not.
And a lot of people use Comcast and therefore have a cap.
So I have 150 meg, but no cap is right. my connection. So anyways, I have some opinions here. First of all,
I'd love to hear it because
you
ordered it, right?
We discussed Stadia when it was announced, and we all three of us said, we'll buy that and review it on the show. I see two of us bought it. You returned yours. I went to sign up for mine. I have a Google Apps account that I pay for, and Stadia you cannot use with a Google Apps account that you pay for. The number of Google services that you cannot log into with a paid Google Apps account continues to be staggering.
Astonishing.
So, haven't used it at all because I'm not signing up for a new Google account just to do that. So,
Hang on. You don't have a non-Google Apps Google account like everybody in the world? Do you not have Jeremy at gmail.com or something?
I probably do have a Gmail account from way back in the day, the one that I was invited. Like when it was an invite-only system, I definitely did get an invite. I'll have to look it up. I'll log in. But not something that I'm astonished. Use regularly, no.
Because I find that most people will use their private for signing up for things like this and Google Photos, and they'll have it on their Android phone. And then they'll have their separate Google Apps account, like their separate G Suite account for just work stuff. So, okay.
Anyway, I use a non-Google account for other stuff. But anyways, so
AOL.
Haven't tried it yet. Would have liked to have been able to try it to say what I think, but wasn't able to. Couple things, though. There's already StadiaCountdown.com counting down the days till Google kills this, which I find fascinating. And I know we talk about Google killing things a lot, and they often do. In fact,
they just
recently did it again.
I saw someone on Twitter wrote one of these things. You quote tweet this with your favorite Google service that got killed, right? And someone responded, "Don't be evil," and I almost burst into tears.
But the thing that I found, I guess, even more interesting is I'm unclear. Oh, getting back to the killed thing, one thing I did find fascinating, my parents are not technical at all. They made a comment about Google not wanting to use a product because Google kills everything, which totally blew my mind. The fact that it's made it that far into the vernacular of non-technical people is a real problem.
It's become a meme, really.
Yeah.
This is like the Ubuntu does spyware people. Thing. It's, wow.
My mind was truly blown.
Jeremy, are your parents just secret Bad Voltage listeners, but they don't want to validate you?
I'm sure not.
I mean, that might be the reason.
So them killing it or not aside, I think it's interesting that they're trying to jump into something early, right? But and there's other companies clearly think there's a market here. Microsoft has Project X Cloud or whatever it is that they're doing a similar thing. Yep. I don't know where this has a fit though, because if it was aimed at people like me, and to be clear, I'm not a gamer, I don't own a console, but if there was a bunch of casual games that weren't AAA blockbusters that I could play that were compelling and interesting when I wanted to blow time, especially when I was traveling, I think Stadia would totally make sense. Gamers who travel want to use something. The problem is, as you alluded to, it takes a ton of bandwidth, and when you're traveling, the one thing that's always wobbly is internet. So travel is immediately out for this, I think, which is the one place it would make sense. So I'm struggling to understand the amount of people that want to play AAA games, that want to pay for every AAA game they play, but don't want to own a console and want to stream it. I don't understand where market fit is for this, because games aren't any cheaper. And game distribution is a hyper, hyper competitive market right now. So why you would go with this over Steam or Epic Games launched their Steam competitor and they're giving away AAA games, I just don't see where this fits in. So I get that Google Cloud has a bunch of GPU instances laying around, and this is probably a great use for them. I don't know how this turns into a profitable product. And don't forget, profitable for Google means generating billions of dollars. If this generates hundreds of millions of dollars, it's an abject failure. So
one of the things,
how it gets that product fit, I just don't understand.
One of the things I think is interesting as well is, obviously most gamers are not streamers, but a lot of people find out about games from streamers and so on. And even if you have a studly enough internet connection that you can stream your game at 4K down from Google's cloud, can you then stream a video of you and the game back up to Twitch at the same time?
I believe you can, because I believe that Google's...
I'm sure Google will have a magic button somewhere which says stream it to YouTube and we'll do it all in the cloud and you don't have to use the bandwidth for that at all. But that's YouTube. Right. At that point, that's flagrant upsell for Google's less popular game streaming service.
Well, that's maybe part of the reason why they're doing this.
It could be, yeah. I mean, the other... from reading reviews, I haven't bought it because I'm not, frankly, I'm not enough of a gamer to warrant it. I'd never buy any games, right? No. I can stream all the games I want in the highest resolution they do off of archive.org, right? Jet Set Willy's, what, 320 by 200? So, not a big problem. Every game that I actually enjoy playing, you could play in a JavaScript emulator of the computer it originally ran on in 1988. So, it's not that big a deal for me. I did look at it, but I'm not sure I've got the bandwidth. Not from a... it's not capped. It's just not that fast. And I just don't need... I'm not going to play the games very much. I did look. But from reading reviews of it, it seems like they've released it kind of early and kind of half finished. I mean, the Stadia controller that you mentioned has got an assistant button on it, but pressing it doesn't do anything because the assistant stuff isn't hooked up yet. And as I understand it,
they've
only
been pretty clear that it's a beta in there.
Yeah, which is fine. And so a bunch of people are pushing back on things like that there's no achievement support and things like that. So yeah, it's a service which is being released as a beta, and that's probably why it's not out to normal people yet, and you've got to be one of the founders or something. But you essentially, that was kind of pitched as a, wow, you're really cool and getting into this early, and actually it's, you're an unpaid beta tester, or you're paying to be a beta tester.
You're paying to be a beta tester,
yes. Yeah, which didn't work. Am I right in thinking there are only 12 games? I read that somewhere and I thought, I must have misread that or misunderstood
they did
it or something.
I think it's more like 25 games now, but it's still
it's not a lot.
Tiny library.
And they're the exact same price from what I can tell as they are. So I looked up a couple of games just out of curiosity. Assassin's Creed Odyssey is on there. It's $59.99. It's also $59.99 on Steam.
Yeah.
The one difference is if you do pay for that 4K subscription, it's $39.99. So if you pay the monthly, you do get a little bit of a discount. So,
and they have, well, there is one exclusive Stadia game, GYLT it's called. I don't know anything about it. Exclusivity to stores is a terrible idea and everyone should pack it in, obviously. But it's a kind of unavoidable thing in the market. But yeah, I mean, I suppose what we should do is, Jono, do you plan on not subscribing to it at all because of the bandwidth issue? This is never
well,
going to go away.
I honestly was getting it because I thought, look, for $150, I'd like to check it out and see what it looks like. And worst case scenario, I'll just flog it. But
I have a stupid question for you, right? Mm. I appreciate that there are a whole bunch of people complaining about tech problems and streaming and so on. But as far as I can tell, these people being super whiny because these games should be 4K and they're actually 1440p, right? But
yep.
I feel like if you were just to sit and play games and they were in 1080p, I reckon you'd probably be okay, right? It's not the end of the world. And then your bandwidth would be all right. Because
well,
it's not like you're super duper hardcore
gamer.
It's
filled with people that just dropped 2K on a graphics card and they want their $2,000 graphic card to do 4K. Where this completely removes the need for any graphics card because you can stream it on anything.
Well,
so it's this is where I don't get where their product fit is.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly assumed the reason I wouldn't be able to use this is because it would need some kind of relatively decent graphics card rather than the potato with a VGA socket I've got on the back of my machine. But no, works fine on my Intel HD 3000 graphics card. So,
basically almost anything.
Yeah, which is great. And all you need is Chrome. So,
but part of the reason why I also don't get the market fit is first of all, in terms of the argument of you don't need to go out and buy hardware, right? 4K streaming, I get that. But the PlayStation 4 has been doing 4K streaming now, or 4K games for how long has it been out? 2012 it came out, something like that. I forget how long it's been out. It's been out for a long time. You can basically pick up a PlayStation 4 secondhand for peanuts if you're on a tight budget, or you can go and buy a new one. So that's one element. The second element is
2013. The game, I've just looked it up.
2013. So it's been out for a long time, right? 6 years. I can do maths. The other thing is that the game library that they've got in Stadia is clearly catering to hardcore gamers.
Yes.
And this is a group of people who buy specialist mice and keyboards so they can reduce the latency of their playing. They buy specialist Wi-Fi units.
Yes.
They buy specialist chairs. Now, those fit people are not going to... Those people are snooty enough against consoles, let alone... Stadia, yeah. Right? I mean, there's like the PC master races, they call themselves.
Yeah. They're just not going to buy this stuff. Yeah. I honestly feel like the people that Google should have partnered with for this is Nintendo.
Yeah.
Right? I can utterly imagine.
Agreed.
The same kind of mental model that made millions of people buy a Wii who have not bought a game console before that and have not bought one since or have bought a Switch. That fits in really nicely with this, I think. You don't need to go and buy custom hardware. It's available to you whenever you want. You're not that bothered about super-duper high-resolution 4K stuff because, you know, Mario Kart's in, what, 720p or something and no one minds.
I think a Netflix-style all-you-could-have subscription cost aimed at casual gamers makes a ton of sense.
And Nintendo can't build this because they haven't got a billion 486s plugged in somewhere. So some kind of partnership seems like a really obvious idea to me. I don't know why.
Never be Nintendo, because Nintendo are more focused on hardware than the rest of them. I mean, Nintendo are killing it with the Switch.
Yeah, the Switch is pretty cool.
The Switch has sold outrageously well. And part of the reason for that is they're always innovating on the hardware side of things, right? PlayStation and Xbox don't really... I mean, they up the oomph of it. But
yeah, not sure innovation is putting the latest graphics card in basically the same box you had last time.
I mean, if you look at, for example, the innovations that have come into... on the PlayStation side of things, with the exception of the VR headset, they've all been a bit of a flop. Yeah, like the little touch bar thing. Yeah, like the Move has been a bit of a flop.
Kinect, the same for Xbox.
Kinect, I think, was pretty successful at the time, but we haven't really seen anything similar to that since then.
Okay.
You know, Nintendo, I mean, they had a flop with the Wii U. The Wii was a massive success, and the Switch is a massive success. The Switch, to be fair, we've got one, is a fabulous games console.
Yeah,
if you've got
it's cool.
Kids. They've done a really nice job with it. And they have a nice selection of games for, you know, like for younger players. So, anyway, we should probably move on.
Yes. So
language, give us some sugar.
Well, hang on. Before we move on slightly, Jeremy, are you planning to continue with the Stadia and get it up and running and see what it's like?
Just for this show, I will dig up my old Gmail account, log into Stadia, and I will give you an update, hopefully, next show.
Excellent. That sounds great to me.
All right.
Okay.
CherryGarcia@gmail.com is revived from the dead.
There's a thing on the list which I really don't care about, but Jono insisted that we talk about it, so okay. So a little bit of explanation first. When I'm peeling potatoes, right, I don't use a potato peeler, I use a knife. And I think the reason I do that is because my mum is left-handed, so she can't use a potato peeler, right? But what this means is when I cut a potato, first of all, a whole bunch of actual potato goes in the bin along with the peelings. And secondly, it's got this kind of very angular, low poly look once I've peeled them. And as far as I can tell, that's what the Cybertruck is.
I was wondering which of the stories you were segueing into based on this potato story, because I don't see a potato story and did not think it was going to be Cybertruck.
Have you seen the thing? It's stupid.
I have.
It does look like a car from Virtual Racer.
This is my point. Low poly truck. Just shut up. Why?
Oh, someone referred to it as a doorstop.
So, go on then, Jono. Explain why Lex Luthor's new thing is cool.
I think it's really interesting because if you look at Tesla and, you know, they've... If you look at what they've accomplished, right? So, first of all, you know, they've got... They came out with their initial Teslas. They released the Model 3 significantly cheaper, right? And the fact that they can produce that car as, you know, at the time when they started pricing it out. And it's not 35,000. It starts at 39,000 realistically. And then there's a whole bunch of extra taxes and fees on top of it. But it's still a relatively cheap car. You know, they've announced the Roadster, which has got like a 680-mile range or something like that. They've got the Tesla Semi trucks. They've been attacking all of these different segments of the market. And pickups, I mean, the Ford F-150 is the fastest selling car around, or truck around. So they had to bring out something. And I just think it's a really interesting concept. Not just the shape. Everyone's talking about the shape, and everybody's talking about the failed glass test, which was quite hilarious to watch.
you should explain that for people who haven't seen it, but it was terribly amusing. Yeah.
So basically, when Elon Musk, they had this whole, you know, the reveal ceremony, and it was all fashioned after this kind of cyberpunk vibe. There were lots of people stood there in like long leather jackets, and there was you know, all this kind of smoke and mirrors and lasers and everything. And they had this guy hit the door panel of the Tesla with a sledgehammer, and it didn't even scratch it. And he whacked a normal truck door and it bent it. And then they did a glass test where they dropped a huge ball bearing on the Tesla armored glass, which was laid flat from a variety of different heights. It didn't even scratch it. And then, you know, it's like, all right, throw that ball bearing at the truck behind Elon Musk on the stage. And it cracked not only the first window, but they had another go at the rear window, and it cracked that one as well. So everybody was tra-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. And the worst thing was that for the rest of the presentation, Elon Musk had to stand there in front of a Cybertruck with two broken windows on the side. But everyone was talking about that. But to me, what was really interesting was the price of it.
Yeah.
Because it starts at, I think it's 39, if I remember correct.
Yeah, so the rear-wheel drive's 39, the all-wheel drive is 49, and the cool one that's all-wheel drive super mode faster than a Porsche is admittedly expensive. It's starting at 70.
$70,000, right. Yeah.
But
given the fact that trucks are expensive in general.
Yeah, exactly. And given the fact that this thing is... I have some sympathy towards the glass breaking thing. Elon Musk basically came out and he said, and actually someone separately said, it's almost certainly that the reason why this happened is if you keep throwing a ball bearing at the same sheet of glass, structurally it's going to start deteriorating.
No, they did a root cause analysis on it. They said it was because Musk came out and said shattered the underneath.
Exactly. Musk basically came out and said because they hit the door with a sledgehammer underneath of it, that will have also contributed to weakening the glass. If they'd have done the glass test first, it probably wouldn't have cracked, and then they did the sledgehammer thing afterwards. Anyway, to me, that was... I'm not worried about that, but they're basically built an armored vehicle. And to sell it for that price, I think is pretty impressive.
I didn't realize how far off it was, though, because I went to the site afterwards just out of curiosity. You can pre-order. It's $100, and it's refundable. Should note, over a quarter million people have already plunked down $100. But the rear-wheel drive one will start shipping in quote-unquote late 2021, which in Tesla speak is mid-2022. And the $70,000 one, they're not even thinking of shipping until late 2022, which is... never, basically. So
right,
this is way off.
It's way off, yeah. And one of the things that I think is interesting as well is there's no mirrors on it. There's no like side mirrors on the car, which is a legal requirement in the US. There's no windscreen wipers on it, which are a requirement in the US. So there's elements of the car that are going to have to change.
Well, you know why that is, right? Because it's a concept car. Have you ever seen concept cars? If you look at them at motor shows and everything, you think, wow, that looks amazing. I'd totally buy that when it comes out.
It hasn't got any mirrors.
Of course it's a concept car.
It isn't a concept car because they're selling it on a website. I agree with you that it's going to change between now and it coming out, but it's not a concept car. A concept car is something that you can't buy generally. But with this case, you can go onto the Tesla website and buy it.
Yeah, I think that doesn't stop it being a concept car. What they've done is they've gone, here's the concept car, buy whatever the hell we end up designing based on this.
I mean, there's no doubt that
it hasn't got any windscreen wipers. There's only so much you can go, oh, look, self-driving technology. I mean, maybe because he lives in California where it never rains, he doesn't think it's a problem.
No, all you do is you crack the front windscreen and then you look out the little hole.
Sounds legit. So
what do you think about it? I mean, I think I know what you think about it, Langridge, in terms of the design. What did you think? What do we both think about, the design of the Cybertruck?
I'm curious if the final will look anything like this. I suspect that it will not be quite as angular. I know Elon Musk is taking a fair amount of heat for his... He gave the reasoning as it's difficult to form 30 times metal with a stamping press. It turns out there's a bunch of cars that already do that, so I don't... There's a little bit of ambiguity in what he means by 30 times, because there's kinds of steel called like 304, 305, 309. A lot of people are taking 30X to be 30 and then fill in the 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Some people are taking it to be like a marketing 30 times stronger thing. So depending on which of those he means, there may already be vehicles that do this. So I'm curious to see how similar it is to... I'm somewhere in between your two opinions with whether this is a concept car or not. It's clearly not that thing looks like the Batmobile concept cars that you will never be able to buy and they're just trying to prove some things. It's not that. But I don't know how close, given Tesla's history, this will be to what ships. The other thing that I think is interesting is, at least in the United States, the truck culture outside of major urban areas is very much the kind of rolling coal culture. And to have an electric vehicle... I'm curious to see what kind of people gravitate toward this and how well it actually sells, because I don't even think this will redefine a category. This will be a new category of vehicle, which we don't see a lot of in the US.
I actually think it's going to be interesting in that note, because I would never ever profess to be an expert in pickup trucks, because I'm not, but I know a lot of people who care deeply about pickup trucks and related to a whole bunch of them. And for example, the fact that it was built so tough, the fact that it's got such a big bed, the fact that it's got onboard power and air is very much speaking to the kind of things that people who buy pickup trucks want. Because, you know, if you certainly in the US, is it Ram, or maybe it's Ford, their whole advertising thing is built tough, right? They're always talking about the strength of these trucks. And it makes sense because these trucks are out in pretty unforgiving terrains. And what's interesting to me that they didn't outline enough in the presentation was just how many superchargers there are around the US. Like, because the only way in which this is going to be successful is if you have superchargers across Montana, Nebraska, these rural areas where people are going to be buying these trucks, right?
I have a US car culture question.
Yes.
Obviously, you've got people who ignore pickup trucks for the moment. I'm thinking about 4x4s, right? So you've got people who buy a 4x4 because they need to drive across fields with it. And you've got people who drive a 4x4 so they can take their kids to school in it, and they might hit a low-sugar Ribena slick on the way, and they don't really need a 4x4, right? Are most of the people buying pickup trucks doing so because they actually need a pickup truck? And if so, are Tesla attempting to create the pickup truck version of a kind of Manhattan 4x4? I call them a Chelsea tractor here, but I don't know if that...
So I think there's two segments of pickup or truck buyers in general, at least from my perspective, and I am very much not. I mean, I live in a city where you wouldn't get down a third of the streets with a giant truck.
I was going to say, this thing, you can't actually drive it around in England. It's like wider than most of the streets.
Right. I think there are, as Jono kind of said, the people that day-to-day use their truck. And then there's definitely a conspicuous consumption, urban, I don't know, Vlieben thing with trucks that has been a little bit more recent, I think, but for whom they will never actually use the utility of the vehicle. It's just they want a truck.
Yeah. I think the thing is the equivalent of what we would refer to as a Chelsea tractor in England, which is often people buy like a Land Rover or something like that. By and large, that is very similar over here, that it's like Range Rover type stuff. And it's also SUVs. Like, there's a lot of people who buy big SUVs. So those people, I think, are going to buy a Model X.
What I don't necessarily mean that it's going to take over the Manhattan 4x4 market. I wonder if... I mean, in the old days, if you bought a Land Rover, it was a Land Rover Defender. You bought it if you were a farmer or you worked on a mountain or something. And then Land Rover created a bunch of things which can ostensibly do that, but they're really being driven by people who have no intention of driving them across a field or anything. And then you started to get bits of that segment of the market which are only suitable for that, right? If you drive a Porsche Cayenne across a field, you'll drop the bloody engine out of the floor. So I wonder whether what Tesla are attempting to create is that sort of thing in the pickup truck market, which doesn't currently exist at all. But you've got to talk tough about it.
I think they're going after rural pickup bikes.
Right, okay. You think they're actually going after people in Montana who drive their truck because they need a truck? You don't think they're trying to sell it to people who live in Beverly Hills who like the idea of having a pickup truck but also like the idea of having air conditioning?
I don't think so, because I think part of the reason is, and this is a car culture thing, certainly in the US, a lot of people who buy pickups in rural areas, they will buy them because they look badass and they're big and they're hard and they're tough and all the rest of things. Like, there are elements of those kinds of trucks, I think, in places like Beverly Hills that would be considered too aggressive in that way. It's one of the reasons why you don't really see as many Hummers around these days, is because I think they're seen as a little, like, people in those areas like obnoxious things, but they're more on the Maserati side of things as opposed to like those big aggressive trucks.
GM have actually threatened only a week or so ago that they're looking to do a family of premium pickups and SUVs and stuff, and they might call them Hummers. They might bring back the Hummer name. So
really,
apparently.
But I just think I just think that if you look at the Cybertruck, the fact that again it's got like onboard air, onboard power, it's got a big truck bed, it's built like a brick shit house. I mean, it's, I would argue that those are the kind of things that the kind of people in Montana are going to want to look for. The thing that I'm surprised by is that they didn't outline the supercharger map, and what they didn't also outline was just the cost differential between filling up a truck like that and charging it. It's way cheaper, depending on where you are in the country, but it's way cheaper to charge and operate a truck like that. So if you're out and about, if you're driving many, many miles, right, the cost savings for a much tougher truck, to me, it's a no-brainer for a lot of people. I don't know why they didn't emphasize that more in the presentation.
Be interested to know whether they think it will do 200,000 miles easily or whatever, like a real truck's supposed to. Oh, Jezza, question for you. The thing where you show up to a Bills game and drink 4,000 beers in the car park before you go in is called what?
Tailgating.
Thank you. That's the name of it. Is this going to be suitable for that? It seems like maybe it would be. Don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, you usually stand in the lot, so the means of conveyance is not big to the actual tailgating.
Why is it called tailgating? I thought you meant to sit on the tailgate. That's why it's called tailgating.
I mean, maybe originally.
A lot
of people take either Uber or public transport to games, so not a lot of tailgating.
Oh, okay.
By the way, also, slight side note, I'm here in Myrtle Beach right now visiting family, and my father-in-law, Vance, is a sports pervert, is the best way of describing it. He's obsessed with almost every sport to great degrees. And I mentioned that Jeremy is a big Bills fan, and he was saying
8-3.
He must be very happy right now with the Bills.
Yeah, they're.
And I, of course, had no recourse to that response to that question to that point. So I just wanted to feel included, Jeremy. That's why I mentioned that.
Very nice.
Right. Do we have anything else?
We've probably got time for one more thing, I think.
Yeah, what do you want to talk about?
Go for it.
I was going to say we got a couple in the hopper there, so.
Yes.
What do you want to talk about, Jeremy? We'll leave it up to you.
Do you want to do Disney Plus or Apple Reviews? We'll save the other one for the next show.
You go for Disney Plus. I mean, I can't participate in this conversation until next March, it turns out. So the two of you talk and I'll just listen.
So in the countries that matter...
Would you honestly get it, though, Ack? Would you honestly buy Disney Plus?
No, right? The only thing that's on it that I might even be vaguely interested in is The Mandalorian. And I'm certainly not that interested in it where I'm prepared to buy into this whole idea that every time I want to watch a new show, I have to pay $6.99 a month subscription for another new stupid streaming service. Right, they tried to do this with Star Trek Discovery and CBS All Access, and I was not fooled, and it's not going to happen again.
So we should start the segment by saying Disney Plus has been announced and released. For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, is a subscription service by a company called Disney.
Called Disney? Thank you for clarifying that, Jerry. It turns out,
also, almost wholly owns Hulu as well. I forgot that because Disney outbid Comcast... They now own... So, for those of you not familiar with Hulu, it's a different streaming service that was one-third owned by Disney, one-third owned by Fox, one-third owned by Comcast. Disney and Comcast got into a bidding war over Fox. Disney outbid Comcast for Fox, becoming two-third owners of Hulu. And at that point, Comcast decided to sell their other third to Disney.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that they owned Hulu.
Yeah.
Hang on.
Interesting.
This is that... That revolutionary mail client.
Yes.
From like...
It's Nat Friedman's...
What was that even
Ajax-y
called?
Hula.
Hula, thank you. It's a joke there for people who've been listening to us talk for 10 years, maybe.
familiar with Hulu is that Hulu's actually US only. They have about 30 million subscribers last time they released numbers. Netflix has about 60 million in the U.S., so they're about half the size. Mm. Although worldwide, they have closer to 160 million. One thing interesting I found with that Netflix has 60 million U.S. subscribers, Disney has estimated that for Disney Plus to break even, they will need roughly 60 million subscribers.
They have to be break even. They have to be as popular as Netflix to break even.
In the U.S., correct. That's what they
call it. Wow, I hadn't seen that. I mean, I can utterly imagine, for example...
To create Disney Plus, they had to pull their content from a whole bunch of platforms that they were monetizing it. So this is... A lot of people seem to be under the impression that, well, it's Disney content, it's free. It's not. There's a very real opportunity cost that they are taking off the table to have the content only on their platform. So what they're betting is that enough people will cancel their Netflix and other subscriptions where they were already getting money for their content but have pulled it and will then subscribe to Disney Plus. And I actually think this is a pretty big gamble. I mean, Disney realistically is primarily a content creation company, not a technical infrastructure company. And for those of you unfamiliar with the engineering at Netflix, it is superb.
Yes.
They have done a phenomenal job of building out infrastructure in a way that I'm not sure I'm convinced Disney will be able to replicate.
All the Netflix royalties
they're giving up, they're really going to have to pivot to be more of a tech company than they are.
Yeah.
Because they're not great at technology. What they're good at, what they're very, 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 very good at, is controlling a message. I might not like the fact that they do it. And we talked in the last show about them deliberately enforcing scarcity over movies that they own in cinemas and so on and reshows in order to control the message, and they're good at that. But if they're required to do something which is not either be good at making films or be really oppressive at writing contracts, I'm not sure. Yep. Do we think they can pull it off? That's a big challenge.
So I think they're going to be successful with this.
Yeah, I think there's two interesting questions, at least to me here, or two interesting aspects. One is, I find it fascinating that we got away from the cord cutters, got away from traditional cable companies, as it were, and it turns out what are probably going to be the biggest streaming providers are the old cable companies in the end.
Yeah.
Because I'm almost sure Comcast will launch something. They have too much content not to. Disney has so much content. And what I think a lot of people forget is how hurt Disney is from cord cutters, because I don't think people realize what percentage of Disney's revenue was ESPN and how expensive ESPN is. So ESPN is in almost every cable package on Earth. Almost every cable package in the US. It represents about $23 a month of your cable bill.
Right.
And all of that goes to Disney, because ESPN is solely owned by Disney.
Wow.
So I don't think people realize every person that cancels cable directly impacts Disney to a pretty substantial number.
So they're
more impacted by cable cutting than people would have suspected.
I didn't know that.
Because of ESPN.
Question for you. What year do you think we will see the first bundled streaming service deal, where you go to some company and you pay them X amount a month and you get access to the following 9 streaming services, i.e. doing exactly what cable did? It's already happening.
Disney Plus did it with Hulu.
And that's because they already own Hulu. I'm talking about...
But you're talking about cross-company. You're talking
This is actually my other interesting aspect. I think it's interesting, and I understand the economics behind it, but I think it's interesting that in the music industry, you can subscribe to Spotify or Google Play Music or whatever you want, and for 99.8% of the music, it's all the same. You're paying for the same catalog. Some go slightly deeper in specific directions, but you're getting into deep cuts at that point. The main content's always there. It is the exact opposite in video.
Yeah,
and I wish there was a service that was more the Spotify for entertainment.
The movie industry are not interested in seeing that happen at all.
No,
I did hyper aggressively
not interested.
I did some work around this around the time of the ultraviolet stuff and everything, and the movie industry sat there and looked at what happened to the music industry and said, "That's not happening to us. Absolutely not."
The dynamics of making video content also is a lot different than the economics and dynamics of making music content.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think part of the reason why Disney have got a reasonable shot at this, there's a few reasons. One is, it's easy to underestimate just how prolific the Disney brand is. It's a brand that people have grown up with for many, many years. And yes, that we can be a little bit critical of elements of how Disney has fostered that brand. And some of the decisions that they've made. But by and large, it's a brand with a great level of love with consumers. So that's one element.
They're one of the half dozen brands that basically everyone on Earth knows, I think. There was Disney, Coca-Cola,
yeah.
A couple of others, but that's it. Yeah, there were like 5 or something.
Yeah, reckon. the other thing as well is that if you go and buy this package, you get Disney stuff, you get Pixar stuff, you get Marvel stuff, Star Wars, National Geographic.
Oh, Touchstone, Lucasfilm. I mean, they own so much stuff.
Yeah.
So I think one element here is, like, we, for example, we have Netflix, we have Amazon Prime. I just got Hulu recently because I'm rewatching Lost, and I couldn't find it anywhere else. And
there it is.
yeah, exactly. And I have to say, the Hulu experience is much better than the others, I think. The content is okay. But if you look at Netflix, often we'll struggle to find something we particularly want to watch. You end up finding something on Netflix, usually a documentary that's okay. And then they have some of their originals. Yep. We often will go to Amazon Prime to find, like, specifically branded stuff that we want to watch, like specific movies that have come out, for example, and you have to pay for it. I think the thing with Disney Plus is the quality of content, in terms of what I think a lot of people want to watch, is pretty high. Yep. But to Jeremy's point earlier on about ESPN, the fact that for $12 or $13 a month, you can get Disney Plus, Hulu, and ESPN, and currently Netflix, it's around $13 a month, I think, just for Netflix. So I think what's going to happen is they've got the brand recognition. They've got incredible content on there. And it's easy to underestimate how important sports is to a lot of people, particularly cable cutters. Like, people will pay a lot of money to watch sports in the US.
Hence, $23 a month just for ESPN, yeah.
Yep. Exactly. So the fact that you could arguably go to someone and say, particularly people who've got kids, and say, you can spend $13 a month for Disney Plus. The parents get sports, a large catalog of material, but your kids have got tons of stuff to watch as well. I think that's going to be unbelievably
compelling. And you've got Hulu, Marvel, Star Wars.
It's setting them up for a lot of success.
I have two questions because you're kind of segueing into my first one. One, do we think that this will be successful? And two, how do you think this impacts Netflix in that if Disney ends up pulling all Touchstone, all Marvel, all Lucasfilms, all Pixar, I know I'm forgetting a couple big ones, and then Comcast launches a streaming service and pulls all NBC, all Universal, which is a ton of the classic movies, and all the other things that they own, that really puts Netflix in a pretty difficult position because their argument has always been our catalog is huge. But if they don't have access to either of those massive catalogs, how do you think this impacts Netflix long term?
I personally think it's gonna be incredibly problematic for Netflix as well, because this is why I think. Remember when Netflix started producing original content and everybody was like, "What?"
Yeah,
but they just put stuff on the internet. That's why that strategy was a smart one.
Oh, it was pretty recent, I think. Yep.
Yeah, but the thing is that the number of hits that Disney has got compared to the number of hits that Netflix has got is profound. Disney know how to make movies.
Yeah, the number of hits that Disney have got looking at their back catalogue. This is the number of hits they bring out every year now by comparison with Netflix, who are a neophyte TV and film production company. I mean, they've got to get into the business because they can't afford to just be buying stuff off other people, because basically everyone else has gone, why would we sell this through Netflix when we can sell it through ourselves and keep all of the money? I feel like Netflix's advantage was that they managed to recognize the way the market was changing before everybody else. Now, whether they recognized cable cutters and provided a service for them, where they created cable cutters by providing a service for them, even back in the days when they would mail you a DVD and then you could just mail it back, right?
Yeah.
They were still streets ahead of all the existing broadcast and TV companies who weren't providing anything like this. But I feel like they stole a march on all the competition. They managed to establish that market, which was obviously a very difficult job. They've made a ton of money out of doing it, but now everyone else has kind of caught up. This is like being one of the people who opens this whizzy new internet bank or something like that. And you get 5 years while the beer moths are still going, well, we're not sure this is going to work and we can't get our processes to work anyway. And then they all catch up with you, at which point they've got infinite money and you're just a startup.
To use a comparison, it's like Apple. Like, Apple are never first.
Yeah.
But then when they bring out their product, they just crush it in the market. And I feel like Netflix were the equivalent of
It'll be interesting to see whether Apple TV stuff that crushes it in the market, because I don't think it's going to.
I don't think it's going to succeed at all. I don't think Apple are very good at services. No. They're great at hardware.
Agreed.
So, but yeah. It's interesting. What's odd to me, though, is that for me personally, I have no interest in Disney Plus. Just not interested in the content. Not interested in any of the Marvel stuff.
I've bored with comic book movies. I've been in your house, and it was Mickey Mouse's House of Mouse on 24 hours a day.
Eric is a huge fan, all right?
Is Paw Patrol not Disney, then?
No. Paw Patrol is some Canadian Disney.
Okay. You're not going to buy it? I'm faintly surprised at that. I mean, you've got Hulu, right? So if you're already paying for Hulu, why don't you just pay for Disney Plus and then you get the Hulu you're buying anyway and a bunch of other Mickey Mouse cobblers?
Maybe, because the kind of content that Disney pushes out, we don't really tend to watch. We don't tend to watch a lot of Disney movies or cartoons. The only time that we tend to watch like Jack will watch, he used to like the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse when he was a baby, but he's not really into that now anymore. He's more interested in watching cooking shows and, you know, Beyblades and all that kind of rubbish.
What the hell is Beyblade?
Beyblade. Parents will be nodding at this point with young kids.
Don't look Beyblades at me, right? My daughter's 19. I can tell you all about El Nombre, if you like, and come outside and all this new stuff.
Beyblades are basically spinning tops. But what they've done is they've broken them into, like, three pieces.
Hang on. So it's not Beyblade. It's
Bay. B-E-Y.
Blade. Right, okay. I'm like, that sounds a bit salacious for a small child.
No, not Bay Blade.
Exactly. Right. Sorry. I've never heard of this thing. Reaction. I don't know. I like Danger Mouse.
Big fan of Fraggle Rock. I don't know. Maybe. I mean, the fact that I started doing a little bit of prep for this show, I didn't know that they had that Hulu, Disney Plus, ESPN. I don't care at all. Like, I am so far to caring about sport, it's almost hilarious. So ESPN, whatever. But in terms of Hulu and Disney Plus, I didn't realize they had that package.
No.
So I'll probably transition to that. But frankly, I think what I'm going to do is when I finish watching Lost, I'll just cancel it.
Yeah. Jeremy, are you buying?
He doesn't have a Google account to buy it with.
No, I don't have a Google account, yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, I do subscribe to Netflix now. I will probably at least check out what the Hulu/ESPN/Disney+ package looks like and potentially subscribe or make the move.
What about you, Mr. Langridge, when it comes to the UK? Because you're a big fan of comic book movies, right?
Yeah, but I don't watch enough television.
Also, Hulu and Disney Plus are not available in the UK.
Yeah. And
I mean, when it comes out, it's coming over in.
It's March the 30th, March the 31st, 2020. Yeah, but no, I don't watch enough stuff. I mean, the number of films I watch in a year, you can count on the fingers of two hands, and half of them I watch in the cinema, at which point I've paid for them already anyway. I don't watch television, so it's no good to me at all.
Wow, I didn't realise you watched 11 movies last year. Sorry.
Yeah.
One of
my hands, one of Anne Boleyn's hands. I'm not even sure I did watch 11 movies last year thinking about it. But yeah,
I did. I don't watch movies very often.
The majority of my movies have happened to be on planes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, there are so many films where someone's like, have you seen this film? And I say, I've seen the first about third of it. And then I fell asleep. And then I watched another 10 minutes where the bloke woke me up and gave me a sandwich with lettuce that was black with cold in. And then I fell back to sleep.
I have to say, though, it's weird. When I'm on flights, I am weirdly productive. I get into this zone of, like, I like doing stuff on planes. And then
I can't do
partway into a long-haul flight, I'll be like, all right, that's enough. And I'll just lay back on, you know,
I can't do anything at all productive on a plane. I hate it. I just try and sleep, yeah. I can't sit and work, can't concentrate. I could barely even read. Which is saying something for me. Yeah. Can't do it. This is why I'm worried about travelling.
You don't like being cooped up, do you?
I do not.
I don't think anyone does.
So it'd be interesting to hear whether people are planning on buying Disney Plus. I mean, as you say, if their goal is not to have people buy it in addition to Netflix, but to have people buy it instead of Netflix, with that content catalogue. If, you know, when Netflix comes up for renewal, maybe, do people do renewal? Is it just monthly now? But are people going to look at it and go, well, why are we paying for Netflix? Because we didn't watch that much on it. And look at all this cool stuff on Disney Plus. Maybe we'll switch. That feels like, it almost feels like the big thing is not going to be how many people buy Disney Plus on release day, which obviously going to be Disney nutcases, people who want The Mandalorian, whatever. It's 12 months from now, how many people have switched to Disney Plus from Netflix?
Right. Yeah.
Might be the important metric.
Who knows? What I do know is that people seem to like The Mandalorian. A lot of people seem to love that show. So
I don't know. All I've heard from people here is people being extremely annoyed that it's not out until March the 31st. So if you were looking to catch a whole bunch of people using torrent clients in the UK, I think this would be your moment.
So well, you could use a VPN.
We didn't have time for that news item.
All right. Well, I guess we should wrap up. This has been a long one.
It has been a long one.
Yeah. But it's been a good time as usual. Have you guys got any speaking or events you want to share in the next couple of months?
I haven't now till the end of the year. But everyone's in DMOB happy mode now, right? For Christmas, or they will be in the next week or so. Try organising a meeting.
Some of us are heading to reInvent on Monday, but yes.
Oh, the AWS thing. Are you speaking or watching?
No. So there's four folks from the team are speaking from Datadog, but I am not one of them this year. But quite a bit of stuff going on. About 60,000 people attend. So fairly large conference.
I was at GoTo in Copenhagen last week, and there was a Datadog stand in the expo, and I dropped your name there in the hope that they might give me a free thing, and they didn't.
So, they give you a free shirt that they were already giving out anyway?
I didn't want the shirt.
No. Was Alan there? Because he seems to be everywhere.
He was not. I would have mentioned it if I'd seen Alan. I'm not speaking anywhere before the end of the year.
Neither am I. I'm happy. No more business travel. So
yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Unlike my wife, she's got lots of travel. So nice. All right. Well
so Jono, what was it like to be on a podcast without telling them how good your book is?
Well, as you mentioned that, People Powered, now available in all good books.
That's all we've got time
for. I'm shocked we made it this far, actually.
Yeah, you know, this is how you sell books, apparently. That's what my PR team keeps telling me anyway. I didn't realize there were so many podcasts with such low requirements for guests.
Brilliant.
Nice. All right, well, everyone go to community.badvoltage.org, share your thoughts on the show, go to the Slack channel, and we will see you in a few weeks.